And good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is State versus Jado J. Jerk. My apologies if I mispronounce that name. And good morning to you, Mr. Smith. You may approach and you may proceed.
Please, the court, James D. Smith, representing the appellant, the state of Nebraska. State v. Gonzalez held that the common law motion to withdraw a plea from a final conviction must satisfy two elements. Number one, the constitutional right must be at issue. And second, that the Nebraska Post-Conviction Act is not and never was available as a means of asserting the constitutional right as the basis to withdraw the plea. Jerky's case fails on the second element. Post-Conviction Act was available to him when he was in custody under sentence, 3 years after being sentenced. Using the language of Gonzalez, the Post-Conviction Act, quote, was available to Jerky. This is because Jerky, like Gonzalez, was in custody under sentence on his final conviction. He just never used the Post-Conviction Act as a remedy. Gonzalez said, quote, if a defendant has a collateral attack that could be asserted under the Post-Conviction Act, that act is his or her sole remedy. Gonzalez is attempting to inject and create a factual and legal knowledge exception to Gonzalez's Post-Conviction Act never available requirement. Gonzalez did not say what Jerky is arguing, which is that the Post-Conviction Act was his sole remedy only if a defendant factually and legally knows he has a collateral attack under the Post-Conviction Act. Per Gonzalez, the district court had no jurisdiction and simply should have dismissed his motion to withdraw his plea.
Counsel, to what extent should we try to reconcile, if you will, the what we expect of defendants knowledge-wise in the three different kinds of relief we afford for these sorts of claims: the statutory relief, post-conviction relief, and the common law procedure?
Well, what I would say the court should do when it invented a new collateral attack remedy in Gonzalez is stick to what the court said, and which was a very limited remedy. And it concerns simply whether it was available. The court dismissed Gonzalez on the basis that she was in custody. The knowledge, legal sufficiency, all of that doesn't make any difference. If it's available and you don't use it, you lose it.
Broad was the window in this case, the window of opportunity?
Well, the window of opportunity was clearly while in custody, and as long as you're in custody and could have asserted it, that's your window, and he clearly was in custody. He's not in custody.
For how long?
Frankly, custody is simply custody. If you're in custody and could have asserted it, I would say that there is no window.
Can you help me with how long?
The sentence here was 4 to 6 years.
I got your question now, Your Honor. Necessarily your window would close within the statute of limitations under the Post-Conviction Act. Even if you're in custody, you would still have to comply with seeking a remedy in which you're within the statute of limitations period, which would be the 1 year. But once you're
One year of what?
Final sentence.
What about the factual predicate for the constitutional claim? What about that element?
I'm not sure I understand
of
what
post-conviction.
You mean. Does the defendant have to factually know about it and legally know its significance?
I mean, under the post-conviction statute, the one-year time limitation, one of the triggering events, if you will, is when, with reasonable diligence, the defendant should have known the factual predicate for the constitutional claim.
That's true.
So when did Mr. Jerky know the factual predicate?
You still have to be in custody. If you're not in custody, you can never assert post-conviction anyhow. If you're in custody, you can assert post-conviction. Frankly, I would say that factual predicate becomes a moot question when you're in custody and could have asserted it. It's available.
It's moot if the path you may have, might have chosen was the post-conviction path.
When it's available to you, it is available to you. I'm not aware that this court has said, like an ineffective assistance of counsel claims, that we're going to start looking at whether or not the defendant, whether or not they come within the Post-Conviction Act, whether they factually knew the claim or aware of the claim. Essentially, his argument that about creating this factual legal knowledge requirement has the effect, what I would say is simply repealing the Post-Conviction Act as an available remedy and returning us back to the days that a person could just wait years, say, gee, I suddenly found out something, and now I'm going to go file post-conviction. And then the effect in this case would be like you're 7 years after the fact, and the state has to go to trial at a case that should have been tried long ago, try to find witnesses who may be dead, long gone, evidence long gone, and reconstruct a case simply because the defendant didn't take advantage of the available remedy. That is going way beyond what I would submit as reasonable for finality, and it is taking Gonzales beyond what Gonzales actually said. In other words, Gonzales creates a remedy on availability, and then trying to then say, and let's create some more exceptions and expand it even more. I would say you reach a point that finality has become irrelevant to the picture, and it should not be.
The district court determined that the state had waived the argument that the Post-Conviction Act applied. What's your response to that?
District court's only rationale was it erroneously applied the civil rules of pleading, and it then erroneously applied those rules to make Gonzales a pleading rule that then the court further erroneously concluded the state waived by not raising it at trial. The record shows the state did make the Gonzales argument, and that's reflected simply by, if you look at T20 of the court's order, the court's actually saying that the state raised it, and the Bill of Exceptions at page 28, 11 to 29 shows that the court allowed the parties to make their arguments by brief rather than orally as part of the trial. So the court's own procedural order makes the trial such that the briefs can raise the arguments. The court's order reflects the argument was made. The waiver conclusion by the court is simply contrary to the record. I would also say that the rationale in State v. Robertson should apply so that the rules of civil pleading don't apply to common law motions to withdraw pleas after having failed to seek post-conviction relief. The rationale under Robertson fits the rationale here. A motion to withdraw a plea, it's not a civil action. It doesn't fit the rationale for liberal pleading notice as stated in Robertson. And by contrast, the common law motion to withdraw a plea is supposed to be a very narrow category of relief where there's a miscarriage of justice. It's not for routine review of defendants' claims.
Can I ask just one more question, time. Going back to Justice Stacy's initial question? Is there a hierarchy of remedies that are potentially available to a defendant somewhat situated like this?
The defendant's remedy of post-conviction is available. File post-conviction.
End of inquiry.
That's the end of it.
Right.
He's not in custody. He's done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Porter, good morning to you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Mark Porto, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Jito Jerky, a refugee from the Sudan here in the United States. The district court in this case evaluated Mr. Jerky's claim in accordance with the Mammer case that this court decided several years ago. And specifically, I would note that the Mammer case involved a motion by the state that was filed prior to hearing pursuant to the Nebraska Court Rules of Pleadings, a motion to dismiss, which was, which this court indicated should have been granted. But the Mammer case, I think, speaks directly only to those situations, unlike here, where the state does file a motion or raise a motion pursuant to the Nebraska Court Rules of Pleading for dismissal for failure to state a claim.
Why do the rules of pleading apply to this at all?
Well, I understand that's probably something this court needs to decide, but that's what Mammer was about. Mammer specifically addressed that case under...
That's because somebody filed a motion in that case.
Right.
We didn't address whether the motion itself was proper or improper.
Well, right. And so I guess on the issue this court needs to decide then is, was that case limited to its facts and it essentially a pleading case that can be waived by the state if they don't raise it through a motion in accordance with Nebraska Rules of Pleadings, or if it's a jurisdictional requirement? And I guess that's for this court to decide.
Even if the rules of pleading apply, normal civil pleading rules apply, are there other contexts in which you waive a defense just by not filing a 12B6 motion?
Sure.
Can't you assert that same defense on summary judgment or even at trial?
Yes, but that never happened here.
Well, they made the argument at the ultimate, the state made the argument at the evidentiary hearing.
They made an argument on the merits, but I don't believe the record indicates that they made a motion to dismiss pursuant to a failure to state a claim.
So this court has held that the common law procedure is only available when post-conviction relief isn't and was never available, and when the statutory relief of withdrawing the plea is not available. So why aren't those material elements of the availability of this common law procedure, why are we talking about them as though they are affirmative defenses?
Well, I think most clearly because the Mammer case was filed came to this court by virtue of a pretrial motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. So that's the direct holding of the Mammer case. And so if the court wants to construe Mammer as being a jurisdictional requirement that my client or somebody similarly situated has to prove up, I would concede that would preclude recovery.
Didn't Gonzalez frame it as a jurisdictional requirement in the last paragraph of the opinion? Didn't the court say that because post-conviction relief was available to Gonzalez, that the common law plea was not and that there wasn't any jurisdiction over the...
Gonzalez or Mammer?
Gonzalez.
Gonzalez.
I'm backing you up a little.
Okay. I understand. I understand that's a reasonable construction of this court's case law. But the Mammer case spoke directly, and its specific holding was in relation to a pretrial motion to dismiss, which is something that can be waived if it's not raised by a timely motion by the party with whom seeks to raise it. But that brings me to the other point I want to raise before this court, which is I would like you, on behalf of my client and others similarly situated, to reconsider the holding from Mammer that, to answer your question to the state, when does that factual predicate start? The essential holding from the Mammer case is that the factual predicate with respect to immigration consequences is the existence of federal immigration law in and of itself. And so if you follow that to its conclusion, in a situation where you have a non-citizen defendant who is convicted and sentenced to prison, they've essentially right at that moment have all the facts that they need, according to the Mammer case, to bring a post-conviction action. And so therefore, right at that moment, the one-year statute of limitations begins to run.
Well, don't they in fact have all, don't they know they're not a citizen?
Correct.
And they know they've been convicted of the offense they've been convicted.
Right.
And doesn't federal law dictate when, under what circumstances, someone would be deportable or not subject to naturalization? And aren't those the pertinent facts, not whether INS ultimately gets around to looking at the case?
I disagree respectfully. I think the pertinent facts are when a reasonable person in the defendant's situation would know that there are real immigration consequences that will stem from that conviction. The entire essence of the Padilla case in the Nebraska, from the U.S. Supreme Court, is that attorneys have a responsibility to provide affirmative advice with respect to immigration consequences when those consequences are truly clear.
So what it comes down to is, my question is suggesting that the rules should be framed when the reasonable person should know that the circumstances could arise, and your framing it would be when they should know that it will arise. Isn't that a fair characterization?
I disagree with that characterization. I think could arise requires some degree of knowledge of immigration law that a reasonable defendant just would not have. And I think Padilla recognizes that. The entire essence of Padilla is that an attorney must provide this advice because it's so important to people who are non-citizens.
So isn't the teaching of Padilla, I hate to interrupt you, but isn't the teaching of Padilla that's exactly what counsel at the time of conviction should be advising?
Yes, prior to the conviction,
right.
prior to the plea, that's what counsel should be advising. Yes, that's what Padilla says. But if you take that to its logical conclusion, an attorney has that responsibility under Padilla precisely because it recognizes that a non-citizen defendant wouldn't have this knowledge of immigration law, and so therefore it's incumbent upon an attorney to provide that knowledge that's so important to non-citizens to them, so they know what they're doing when they enter into a plea. And charging a defendant with the knowledge from the moment they step foot in prison is just, I think, it puts Padilla, it renders Padilla largely irrelevant, because right when they go into prison, when they have restrictions on liberty, significant restrictions on liberty, they're charged with acting as a better attorney than the attorney that they had when it comes to learning in the intricacies of federal immigration law at a time when the person has no expectation of having any immigration problems because their attorney never told them, which under Padilla they should have known. I think
counsel, I hate to interrupt also, but you said that you're suggesting that Mr. Jerky didn't have any idea that there were really going to be immigration consequences, and my understanding of the record is that while he was serving his prison sentence, he knew that there had been an immigration hold placed on him because he couldn't get the kind of community custody release that he was seeking. Why isn't that the kind of notice that you've been asking us to focus on?
Yeah, I mean, he was provided a limited warning to the extent that he couldn't receive community correction, but that's, I think that's largely is understood to be a DCS policy, a DCS requirement.
An immigration hold was a DCS policy?
Well, his access to community corrections. What he never received was any indication that you are being deported. He did not receive that until November of 2017. And that's when a reasonable person in his position, I believe, would have had the facts necessary to genuinely understand that the issue, that this was an issue. And when he got that notice, he immediately sought recourse. But even if you assume that, there are other people who are going to be in this situation who, under the Mammer case, would be construed as having all the knowledge that they need to have the second they go into prison. And I would just ask you to reconsider that. And I want to present one more argument of why I believe Mammer was wrongly decided and should be reconsidered by this court. Under Mammer, if a person had access to file a post-conviction act, they are governed by the one-year statute of limitations. That's what Mammer says. I'm asking you to reconsider that. But you can envision a situation where somebody, for example, is convicted of a Class 4 drug offense, which would render them readily deportable, but they could be given a fine only and never been subject to the post-conviction act. That person could be 4 or 5 years down the road, receives an immigration notice, they can proceed under Gonzales. Whereas if somebody went to prison, may I finish my thought here?
You may.
Okay. If somebody went to prison, had their liberty restricted, they're limited to the 1 year statute of limitations under the Post-Conviction Act, and then could never, under Mammer, avail themselves of the Gonzales procedure. That doesn't, I don't believe that makes any sense. And I think it's fundamentally unfair, and I would ask the court to reconsider the decision of the Mamre case.
Did your client receive an immigration advisement before he entered his plea?
He received the cursory advisement from the court, is all he received, which is inadequate.
It's inadequate?
Well, it's not inadequate for the statutory realm, but it's inadequate to overcome the constitutionally ineffective assistance of counsel, which under Padilla requires affirmative advice with respect to truly clear immigration consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 1 minute and 24 seconds, Mr. Smith.
Couple things. In response to Justice Castle's questions about reasonable discovery objective facts, the record in this case shows that the defendant did receive the statutory immigration advisory. He acknowledged he understood it. That advisory advised him that he could be removed from the United States. And when you look at what Padilla actually said, Padilla said the holding is that must be advised. We now hold counsel must inform his client whether or not his plea carries risk of deportation. He was advised of that risk. He acknowledged he understood it.
What should have counsel advised at the time of the plea? Different than what the trial
court. I would refer the court, because I'm running out of time, to State Lee v. U.S. 137 Supreme Court 1958. I think it answers that. The other thing, as noted by Justice Stacy, and it appears at page 918 of the Bill of Exceptions, Jerky was aware when early in his sentence, when he was in custody, that a hold had been placed on him by immigration. If I could close by saying Justice Kagan of the U.S. Supreme Court uses a short phrase during her oral arguments that accurately summarizes lack of merit to his argument, and that is, you snooze, you lose. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our